Arizona's 2022 abortion ban is extreme and hurts women. And the near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state.
Arizona Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs yesterday, after that state's Supreme Court reinstated an 1864 abortion ban passed really decades before Arizona was even a state. It bans abortion from the moment of conception and makes no exceptions for rape or incest. It also criminalizes the procedure, meaning doctors could face prison time if they perform one. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, said today he thinks this ban goes too far. Just a few days after he said abortion should be left up to the states and declined to support a national ban. Abortion rights activists in Arizona say they have enough signatures to put a measure on the ballot this fall, which would enshrine abortion protections in the state's constitution. We're going to talk about all this now with two guests. Alice Miranda Olstein covers healthcare policy for Politico and has been closely following what's been happening in Arizona. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And Michelle Goodwin is a professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown and author of the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
All right, Alice, let's begin with you. Tell us exactly what this law would do and when it would go into effect.
Well, exactly when it will go into effect, we don't know yet. So there's a lot of fear and confusion on the ground right now in Arizona because the state Supreme Court kicked some questions back to the lower court. And I guess we're in this moment where abortion access is at least up to 15 weeks, still going to be available through the next month or so. But beyond that, it's still really in flux. We also don't know if the state legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, will respond and try to pass something in that will impact abortion availability and not allow this complete sweeping ban to go into effect.
Wow. So it is really in flux. Michelle, what is your reaction from a legal perspective to this ruling that upholds a law from the Civil War era?
Well, to be clear, when we say Civil War era, it's important that we note this is an era where slavery is still legal in the United States, where states can still bind people, force people into reproductive servitude, and also that we understand that these laws do not come out of thin air. This was in direct response to the fact that abolitionists had gained momentum and the dawning of slavery being put to an end. This concern that if the Union wins, there will be this browning of the United States. Abortion criminalization comes out of that period, which is why it's relevant that it's Civil War and slavery era in the United States.
Interesting. Also, women couldn't vote and wouldn't be able to vote for many decades after.
That's absolutely right. This is a time in which coverture rules the land, that husbands may lawfully rape their wives. Husbands may beat their wives, where there are state Supreme Courts that say, close the curtains and shut the door. These are private matters. So that's the context in which this law comes about.
And Alice, what about other states? Where does this law fit with other states that have recently passed bans or near total bans?
Yeah, so we have now a lot of states that have near total bans. Not all of them date back to the 1860s, although there was one that was nearly around that old in Michigan that voters overrode with a ballot initiative, which is what Arizona voters are hoping to do themselves this fall. So you have all of these cross currents right now where state lawmakers are putting forward legislation to dictate abortion access. At the same time, in states that have the ability to do a ballot initiative, which is not all states, that effort is moving forward as well. And every time groups have put a ballot initiative forward to protect or expand abortion rights, it has passed overwhelmingly. And so they're hoping to do that in Arizona, in Florida, in many other states in just a few months.
I'm wondering, though, politically, if this is as salient an issue in the general election as it is in, as we've seen, in either primary elections or in off-year elections. So you get a different class of voter, right, who comes out every 4 years, what people call a low propensity voter, people who aren't really that into following the day-to-day politics, but turn out reliably every 4 years. Is abortion as important to this voter? And is that something that Biden and the other Democrats are going to have to rely on? And are they, is it a little bit of a gamble?
I think the behavior of candidates on both sides show they do think it will be a major issue. As you've noted, we haven't had a presidential election since Roe versus Wade fell. And so all of this sort of data we have so far is from midterms and off-year elections, some of them, you know, very off-year, you know, in the middle of August, special elections here and there. All of those show that supporting abortion rights has been a winner for candidates and for policies when there have been these direct votes. But again, we haven't had this in a presidential year, so we don't know how Trump and Biden being on the ballot will impact things. But I do think that it's clear that both the Biden and Trump campaigns thinks this could be determinative. Otherwise, you wouldn't see them coming out with the statements they've been coming out with. Trump just this week, you know, backing away from the idea of supporting a national ban that he had previously openly been flirting with and saying this should be left to states. And the Biden campaign really leaning into it, running ads that are, you know, featuring heart-wrenching stories of women who were denied abortions and suffered physical harm as a result. They're, you know, sending some of those same women to act as campaign surrogates on the campaign trail in certain states. And so I think them and looking down the ballot, looking at Senate candidates and House candidates' behavior shows that, you know, everybody really thinks this could move the needle.
Right, right. Even Carrie Lake, who had supported this 19th century law, is backing away from it. Michelle, I want to play a clip of tape from Arizona's Democratic Attorney General Chris Mayes from yesterday.
As long as I am Attorney General of the state of Arizona, no woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law. Woo! Not by me, nor by any county attorney serving in our state, not on my watch.
So, Michelle, what do you make of that? She's openly defying a state Supreme Court decision.
Well, it's a rather bold presentment. And let's be clear that prosecutors have discretion. But here's some other things. She's making a very bold presentment in this instance, saying that here's something that she sees as unjust. And so she's going to use the power of her office to not criminally prosecute those individuals who might aid others in terminating a pregnancy, that she's not going to go along with the draconian law and prosecute, which is within her discretion. That said, that is only as strong as she is still in office. That is only as strong as prosecutors pay attention to her and say, I will agree. In the state of California, in the wake of there being constitutional protections to the right to privacy, there have been prosecutors that have sought to prosecute women for stillbirths and miscarriages. Granted, it's incredibly isolated, but that's even taken place in a bastion that's like California, where there are innumerable protections for reproductive health rights, privacy, and justice.
So, Alice, what does this mean for any possible legislation on a national level that would do that, protect abortion rights rather than, you know, set up a national ban? Is there more appetite for that now in the wake of this Arizona decision?
I think the idea of national legislation in either direction is still pretty remote possibility at this point. We've seen over the last several years, Congress unable to pass either national restrictions or national protections, even when one party controls both the House and Senate. Part of that is because of rules requiring supermajority votes, you know, the Senate filibuster being among them. But you've also just seen a lot of difficulty on either side getting consensus around what the right policy is to move forward. What I think people are expecting more of is action on the executive level, which makes the stakes of the upcoming presidential election even higher, because there are a lot of things that should, you know, Trump return to office, for instance, there are a lot of groups that are working right now to prepare policies and executive orders for Trump to implement that would functionally ban abortion without Congress getting involved at all. A lot of anti-abortion groups are part of that work. And so they're putting forward things like directing the FDA to pull authorization for abortion pills nationwide, which those are used in the majority of abortions. So that would, you know, in one fell swoop, cut a lot of the procedure away. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of many, many things that people are looking into. Of course, there will be bills introduced, but the expectation is that they will not be able to move forward unless one party wins a huge wave election, which we really haven't seen in a while.
Okay. Well, speaking of the FDA, Michelle, the Supreme Court is now considering whether the FDA has the ability to approve mifepristone, an abortion drug. How do you think they're going to rule on that?
Well, the oral arguments in that case really showed the cards of the justices. It seemed both the liberals and the conservatives were really quite skeptical of this particular case that comes out of Amarillo, Texas. That's where the lone sitting district court judge Kaczmarek is. It's a case where the justices were skeptical about these individuals who brought it having standing. They're framed as doctors, but amongst them is a person with a master's degree in theology, another one who's a dentist. It's a case where the statute of limitations would have told within the first 6 years. Mifepristone was approved in the market in 2000. Now we're 24 years later. The claims were that this is a drug that is unsafe and not efficacious. That, too, has been something that's been revealed to be untrue. So it's doubtful in that case that the Supreme Court will give sway to the plaintiff's claim. It's also worth noting that pharmaceutical drug makers have come forward and have issued an alarm bell saying that if this could happen with mifepristone, what could possibly be with other drugs in the marketplace for groups that don't want there to be COVID vaccines or other kinds of vaccines? They, too, could try to form shop for the right kind of judge that might lean into their case. And that is a valid concern. And it seems that the Supreme Court justices were taking all of those matters into account during oral arguments.
All right. So final question to you, Alice, in terms of the electorate, when you talked a little bit about this, in terms of this being an animating issue, when you've also got the economy and you've got inflation still higher than people would like, how important is this for the general election voter, given the whole scale of what's happening in the country?
Yeah, so polling shows that it is more of a motivating issue for Democrats than for Republicans right now, which makes sense given what we've seen over the last few years. And it's interesting, I've talked to a lot of anti-abortion activists who are really worried about that and who see it firsthand when they go, you know, door-to-door canvassing. They said they're seeing some apathy, some, well, we already won at the Supreme Court. We killed Roe versus Wade, so now we don't have to do anything anymore. And they're really hoping to light a fire under people and get them to still turn out and vote on this issue. Democrats, on the other hand, are much more fired up, especially those, you know, living in the states and really experiencing these bans firsthand. I think that's been really motivating for a lot of people, including, you know, these ballot measures that have passed over the last few years. A lot of them have passed with the support of a lot of moderate Republicans and independents voting for them. And so it definitely proves to be an animating issue. And you know, I think it really shows the difference between being asked about abortion rights in theory and really seeing firsthand, knowing someone, knowing a friend or family member who, you know, ran into one of these bans when trying to access care.
Alice Miranda Olstein, she covers healthcare on Capitol Hill for Politico. Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, and also author of the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Michelle and Alice, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
you're at a cocktail party, you meet someone, you have a great conversation, and then you can't remember their name. You go to the grocery store and you forget what you were supposed to buy. You forget the name of the movie you saw last night. Relax. We'll tell you why that's normal. A new book explores the science of memory. And later on, why LA's dog shelters are overcrowded now despite a pandemic adoption boom. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I am sure this sounds familiar. You walk into a room and forget what you went in there for almost immediately. You forget where you put your keys, your wallet, your phone for the gazillionth time. Or maybe you can't remember the name of the person you had a long conversation with at a party just last night. I'm sure you have asked yourself, why am I forgetting these things? Do I have a problem with my memory? Is it early onset? My next guest says we should be asking ourselves instead, why do I remember? Dr. Charan Ranganath is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UC Davis. In his new book, he argues that we're not supposed to remember everything and that we have the wrong expectations for what memory is for in the first place. His new book is called Why We Remember: Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. And he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I think that is really common, right? I have that feeling all the time when I can't remember someone's name, someone I know really well, for example, that happens. And I think, is this early onset dementia or what's happening? Is my brain aging in a way that I don't want it to age? Is it true that when we get older, we can't remember things as well?
It is true that as we get older, our episodic memory, which is our ability to remember events, tends to decline. That's an average, though. Some people, as they get older, don't show any decline that you can measure. And some people, as they get older, have a real steep decline. So it really varies, and we're still trying to understand exactly why. But the important thing is that the kind of forgetting that we have the most often is not really the kind that's worrisome. So I think a lot of people will worry for exactly the kinds of things that you talked about, which are all totally normal. Even in younger people, that happens. And as we get older, it happens more and more commonly.
Why does it happen more commonly? Is there a set finite space in your brain for things to remember?
No. Yeah, it's a common question. But no, in fact, there's not really any evidence suggests that people hit any space capacity limitations. And the reason is that our brains are very economical about how to store memories in the first place. We think that at least one school of thought, which I subscribe to, is that what the brain is optimized for is to give you the information that's new, surprising, biologically important, and to dump the rest. And that is why we tend to get memory and then to recycle the knowledge that we have so that you're not starting from scratch every time. And so that's why we don't seem to hit these capacity limits. The problem that we have is usually that we don't have a way to get back to the memories that we need at the moment that we need it. So for instance, it's not a matter of remembering the name, you know, John or something like that, but rather pulling the name up when you see that person's face. That's the hard part. And then sometimes when people tell you, you're like, oh, yeah, that's the name. So you have a memory somewhere in there, but you just couldn't find it.
Why is it that sometimes you can find it and sometimes you can't find it?
Oh, there's so many reasons. I'll give you just one, which is that so the way episodic memory works, that's our memory for events. It associates information according to the context in which things happen. So the place, the time, the emotions that you're feeling, background music, all these kinds of cues. And so there's often times where we're blissfully ignorant about some memory that's sitting there and it seems to lay dormant. But then you go to a place that you haven't been to since you were a child, or you hear a song that you used to listen to during the summer when you turned 16, or you smell some food or reminds you of something that your grandmother cooked, and it just brings back a memory, like as they just come rushing back. And part of that is because when you have reminders that take us back to a particular place and time, that can give you that sense of remembering that you otherwise wouldn't have, because it helps you find the memory.
Why is it that sometimes I'll remember things that aren't significant at all? And I mean, I understand that the brain holds on to things that are new, surprising, novel, shocking, what have you, because it shakes you out of your normal everydayness. And it's remarkable, so you remember it. But sometimes we remember things that are not remarkable. Why?
Well, I mean, it's always hard to reverse engineer any particular memory that you might have. But sometimes what can happen is that, especially as we get older, some of the data suggests that what we have trouble with is regulating our attention. And so we can be distracted by things that just grab our attention because we're not as good at being able to focus. And so as a result, that's why, in fact, there's some data to suggest that even though older people on average are worse at remembering the things that they're supposed to, they can often be as good or better at remembering things that were inane that they weren't supposed to remember.
Oh, great. Okay. That's not very
But that's
reassuring.
That's okay. You still have that ability, and there's definitely things you can do about it.
Right. Well, okay. So let's talk about that then. How can we make sure that we remember what's important and trash what's unimportant?
So one of the things I think that really helps is to remove the distractions that really grab us. So for instance, we have alerts, and I've been trying very hard to keep, I've got to figure out how to way to permanently do this, but I'm trying to remove all notifications from my phone and computer because those things pull away at our attention, right?
Yeah.
We often keep ourselves in environments where there's all sorts of noises and, for instance, that grab us when we're supposed to be focusing. And then we often do it to ourselves by constantly trying to switch between things that we're doing. So for instance, if I were to try to check email while you were talking to me, I would have a very hard time remembering what you're talking about. So that's definitely one thing I think that people can do. And then there's, of course, some lifestyle things that I could recommend too as well.
Like getting a good night's sleep, like eating well, those kinds of things, exercise.
Getting a good night's sleep, eating well, exercise. Then there's some real surprising ones that are just coming out. So one is for people who have older people who have hearing problems, wearing a hearing aid can help with preserving memory over time. There's things like teeth and gums. And actually, there's some evidence suggests that keeping oral hygiene can be related to maintaining good memory function as people get older.
And there are different parts of the brain related to different kinds of memory, right? So there's the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, two parts of the brain that are important for memory. What do each of them do and how do they relate to each other?
Great question. So the hippocampus is thought to be one of the most important areas for episodic memory because it's basically grabbing information from many areas of the brain. And one way you can think about it is it's talking to some of the most, you know, high level areas of the brain, but it's randomly putting together whatever those areas are telling it. So in other words, you're sitting in the middle of a conversation and you're in a particular place and you're talking to a particular person and you have a particular goal in mind. And the hippocampus puts all that together to say, hey, at this moment, here's what was going on. Now, the functions of the hippocampus, though, are regulated in a very important way by the prefrontal cortex, which is talking to many of the same high-level areas of the brain. But what it's doing is it's kind of regulating and overseeing all these different brain areas towards this common goal that you have inside, right? So, in other words, like right now, I have half a donut sitting in front of me. And my prefrontal cortex is saying, please do not grab that donut. You need to actually focus on this conversation. And what that allows you to do is use memory in a very intelligent way. It allows you to use strategies when you want to memorize something and keeps you from getting distracted.
So if you are, let's say, studying for an exam, how can you make sure that you remember what you study and not just forget it as soon as you finish your exam?
Yeah, so for remembering things for an exam, my best advice is to harness the power of what I call in the book as error-driven learning. And so the idea there is that you learn the most when you actually force your brain to struggle and pull out the information. So in other words, when people are trying to study for a test, or even if they're trying to practice things like practice lines for a play or practice a presentation that you're going to give for your business. The more that you actually force yourself to try to recall that information, like so for a student to test yourself instead of just studying the textbook over and over again, you actually get a lot more learning that allows the memory to last. The other thing is anything that prompts you to really think about it and relate what you're seeing to your prior knowledge and to say, hey, this is new and it changes the way I think about X. Or, hey, this relates to this other thing that I'm trying to study. Those are all great. So, notes, for instance, if you take a note and you're like, hey, this reminds me of this other topic that I'd studied, then what happens is instead of having all these little fragments of bits and pieces that you're trying to memorize, you now have this rich network of ideas.
Right, which links to what your point is when it comes to remembering how things happened. And you talk about Brian Williams, the former NBC News anchor, as an example. And he lost his job when he said that he had been shot at when he was in a helicopter in Iraq and forced to land. And it turned out that didn't happen. And so he apologized for it. People thought he was lying to make himself look like a hero, but you argue that there should be a more kind of empathetic, sympathetic reading of what he said and what he remembered.
Yes. So I was really interested in this Brian Williams case because it's quite possible, and we don't know, right? We can't get into his head, only he knows. But it's quite possible, based on the research that's out there, that in fact, Williams was not trying to put one over on people. But what happened was he would recall that experience. And when people recall the past, they just get little fragments of the past. You never get everything. And so then what happens is people use those fragments to construct a story. It's basically we don't replay the past, but we imagine how the past could have been. So let's say if you think of yourself as someone who's this gutsy journalist who goes where the action is, maybe when you imagine that memory, you'll imagine yourself being more central and having this kind of more courageous part of the story. And so when you fill in the blanks between all these gaps that you remember, you might embellish it in a way that makes you look better, just unintentionally. And most people do this. Most people remember themselves more positively than they really were. So then, every time you recall this event, now information that happens during the time of remembering starts to corrupt your original memory. And so it's easy for memories that you've recalled many times to become more and more and more embellished and drift farther and farther from what happened. So in the case of Brian Williams, there was a helicopter that crashed. And in fact, he ended up being stranded, I think, in the middle of the desert, if I remember the story correctly, with a number of other helicopters. And so all the elements in his story were there. It's just that he put it together into a narrative that was completely wrong.
Yeah, so I guess we all do that. But as Joan Didion once said, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. But here's the thing. I think I'm really good at short-term memory and remembering things in a quick turnaround because I have to do that for my job. But in terms of long-term memory, I don't really have a lot of really clear, detailed long-term memories.
Well, so I'm like this too, actually.
You
So
are?
I can relate to you. But I looked at this and I asked myself, okay, so in fact, actually, one of my colleagues who studies autobiographical memory, he thinks that I have severely deficient autobiographical memory, which is memory for the experiences in your lifetime. And I don't vividly remember most things, but what I'll say is that I never really struggled in school. And anything that involves something that sort of brings out in me my attention and my interest or ties on to my prior knowledge, I can just absorb fairly well. So I think sometimes what it is we live in our heads. I know I do. So we often don't remember the experiences that we've had, but we remember what we're thinking about or feeling at the time, as opposed to what we actually saw or what we heard and tasted.
And maybe it's a blessing, really, to forget most of it. Because maybe most of it is forgettable. I don't know.
Absolutely. I think that I believe our brains are much more optimized for economy, right? So my phone has a photographic memory. If I go to ChatGPT, it actually, gets something from every piece, every pixel of data that it gets in. It's influencing it. But for us, I think we're more designed to stop on a dime and be flexible and nimble mentally. And I think that's the ability that you get from having a very selective memory.
Okay, we'll end on that positive note that we have something on the AI.
Oh,
One
absolutely.
little
Yeah, I
thing.
could go on and on and on about that. There, AI is useful, but it's totally different from what people do.
For now, anyway.
For now.
For now. All right. Well, it has been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
It was fun. That's Dr. Charan Ranganath. His book is called Why We Remember: Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. Coming up, Los Angeles dog shelters are seriously overcrowded and it's hard to see.
Smelly, upsetting. There's no way to choose. There's no place to start because it's been allowed to literally get out of
We'll
control.
find out why next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles animal shelters are so overcrowded that the city council yesterday voted to pause issuing dog breeding licenses. The system is more than 200% above capacity. Dogs are living in crates that are overflowing into the hallways. They're being housed outdoors. They aren't getting walked. They have very little attention paid to them. And euthanizations are up by more than 20% compared to last year. Joining me now is Madeline Bernstein, president of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Los Angeles. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so what do you make of the city council's decision to pause dog breeding licenses? How will that ease the overcrowding problem?
It won't. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm absolutely not in favor of breeding. I think, as you can see, there are plenty of available dogs. We don't need to make more. However, this is not the solution. And there are statistics where they cite that they're going to reduce the number of breeding permits, by 1,000. There's no research that will then follow that to see if the dogs coming into the shelter are a result of that particular breeding permit. Also, I can get a dog from a breeder anywhere else and still turn that dog into the Los Angeles City Shelter where I live. So I actually think that this was just an exercise in optics. The ordinance itself that they approved is really poorly written and doesn't take into account the actual job of the animal control department, including this pet overpopulation problem. And I think that this is really sad. I think, they're trying to congratulate themselves that they did something, this one thing, but this is not a thing that will make a difference. It's just making everyone feel good.
Right. So what is behind this? Because during the pandemic, everyone was adopting dogs like crazy, and the shelters were really happy about that. So what's happened? People who adopted dogs in the early part of the pandemic and were working from home are now returning to work, and they can't take care of their dogs anymore.
That's one reason. And most of those are foster people. People who adopted animals who we see who are returning them have either lost their job, relocated, or cannot get alternate housing where they can have a pet. And that problem is twofold. One is that there is really a shortage of pet-friendly rentals, pet-friendly housing. That's one problem. But the real problem, as always, is the insurance companies, who, even if you have your own house, will dictate whether or not they will cover you on homeowners for a specific kind of pet. So basically, it's a perfect storm that has converged between economic problems, housing problems, insurance problems, the fact that many of those animals were fosters and not adopted in the first place. So you have a problem like that. The other problem that we have in the nation, not just California, is there's a huge veterinary shortage and veterinary tech shortage.
So does that mean these dogs are not being fixed, if you will, and so they're
Correct.
breeding?
Correct. We have more puppies than we used to have.
Oh, okay. What about cats? Is this the same problem with cats, or is this mainly a dog problem?
Well, cats don't take up as much room as dogs, and cats are to some extent seasonal. So, like right now, for example, we've just entered kitten season, which means that cats are going to be filling up shelter spaces as well. So, if you know that there's too many animals, to me, the logical place would be to close in on spay neuter requirements, closing the gap with license fees. How are they proving that you're eligible for a breeder's permit? What's your business plan? Are there restrictions? Are there inspection requirements? Are there other things that go into regulating a legitimate business?
But isn't that then, maybe why the city council did this to prevent people from just getting dog breeding licenses to avoid spaying or neutering their pet?
This is not going to affect all the backyard breeders, where most of these animals are coming from anyway. Unless you can correlate the breeding permits to the excesses in the shelter, you're not going to really know what you're talking about.
So, in the absence of any crackdown on spaying and neutering and all that, there's just going to be more euthanasia.
So the number of euthanasias obviously could go up if you have more animals and a percentage of those animals are not adoptable. But that's always true. So if you have a vicious animal, one that's not suitable to be adopted, if you have an animal that's so sick that you're not going to find an adopter, you don't want to have that animal suffer in a cage, let alone in these absolutely outrageously inhumane crates, okay? Or in, stuffed into small places. That's no way for an animal to live. So the euthanasia decisions are going to be the same regardless, because certain animals will never be able to be adoptable. And so the philosophical question is, are we going to warehouse them eternally, in a crate, in a cage, or are we going to make a decision? But the other issue is this ordinance is not very clarifying at all, and it doesn't even take into the account that the only function of an animal control agency is not housing, okay? It's getting licenses enforced. So animal control officers sell licenses and have to make sure that animals are licensed. They have to investigate case of animal cruelty. So where do they put those?
Can you just describe to me what it looks like? What kinds of dogs are in these shelters? And just, you've obviously walked the halls with them. What does it look like to you?
Well, if you're walking through an overcrowded shelter that's not being managed, it can be very smelly, inhumane, and painful. And the problem with that is that you wouldn't want to take a dog out of there. You wouldn't want to work there. You wouldn't want to volunteer there. And so you end up creating a vicious cycle. And because the rest of your operation isn't working, and you don't have You should always have open cages for the other facets of the animal control business, like taking in a stray or taking in an animal who is being cruelly treated. So what you have is a very smelly, if you think about your senses when you walk into a place like that, that looks like that, Animals are sitting in their own waste in the crates because they don't have a way to get away from it. So it's on them. So they're sitting in their own waste. Many of them are sick. They have issues, you know, that ha they have to be medicated and treated. So you walk in and you're hit. Usually the first thing that you are hit by is the smell. Then you see animals piled on top of each other, dirt, feces all over the place, things that are not cleaned, rodent droppings that are all over the place. You see that. And you can hear sometimes a lot of barking, a lot of whining, a lot of crying, or worse, you can hear absolute silence in some cases, which is like one of the telltale signs when you're investigating animal cruelty. Silence is a very strong factor of a problem. A normal dog isn't going to say nothing. So you walk into a place like that, which is smelly, upsetting, and it's inhumane. And walking in should shock the conscience of everybody walking in and say, you know, who's in charge here? What's happening? Because that's what it looks like. That's what it feels like. It's sad. And also, what are you adopting at that point? You know, you may have an animal that was adoptable before living in a crate for months and is now just a wreck. You know, and animals can devolve very quickly in the animal shelters.
Like many of us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome anytime.
That's Madeline Bernstein, president of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Los Angeles. Coming up on Press Play, hundreds of 99 cents only stores are going out of business. Why that's a big loss next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The 99 cents only stores, you've seen them. You can't miss their ubiquitous pink and blue signs. Well, they will soon be no more. The company announced last week that it's closing all 371 locations. The CEO blamed a combination of the pandemic, inflation, and more demand for online shopping. He also mentioned retail theft. Other dollar stores aren't really faring well either. The chain Family Dollar plans to close hundreds of stores in the next few months. Still, though, these stores are a Southern California staple. They were founded here more than 40 years ago. And it's a real loss for people who rely on these stores, according to my next guest, Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi there.
Hola, Madeline.
So when you learned about this closure of all of these stores, I didn't realize there were so many of them, 371. What did you think?
I was just sad. I mean, you think of them, you don't think of it as a chain, as you pointed out. You think of it as your neighborhood store. That's the place where, you know, your friends who are trying to find crazy discounts go. That's where working class folks go. That's where retirees go. That even, and you know, and so I was just sad. I personally, I don't shop at them that much because I'm more of a swap meet type of person. But I just thought, geez, here's another Southern California standard. I mean, what's going to be next? Norms? Please, Norms, do not leave us.
No Norms. I know. Plus, when you go in there, you never know what you're going to find. And there's always some kind of crazy delight in there.
Oh, my God. Well, I always loved, because I'm a food guy, of course. And so I was just looking at these canned products and I'm like, okay, so this off-brand sriracha, I wonder if I could even find it online. What is potted meat? I've never heard of potted meat before. And me personally, of course, anytime I could find tamales in a can, I buy it and I show it to my cousins and see, Americans used to buy tamales in a can and some still enjoy them.
Exactly. And they're good for decorations too, like holiday decorations, birthday decorations, tons of balloons and all that stuff, which I really like. So you kind of feels like a party in there. And now, though, it doesn't really feel like a party. I guess it feels more like a funeral. You went to one recently, and what was it like?
Yeah, so I went to the one off of Main Street near the Chase Bank at Santana. If you know Santana, you know exactly where I'm talking about. Go there on a Sunday morning. It's not completely crowded, but more and more people are coming. And everyone was offering condolences to the workers, people telling stories like, I've been shopping here since I was a kid. Now I'm an adult and I go there. I've been here 20 years. I always come here to feed my family. And everyone's like, it wasn't pandemic level, like, let's just get rid of everything ASAP. No, people were really picking what they wanted to buy right there and then. What I found interesting, though, was like everyone seemed to have an extra package of toilet paper and cleaning towels.
Oh, okay. And so is it cheaper in general to shop there than, let's say, Amazon?
You know, Amazon's always going to be a race to the bottom, just like Walmart, for that matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've had discount stores as long as the United States has had stores of any kind. I mean, let's not forget the Sears catalog. They promised cheap, the cheapest prices possible. But with 99 cent only, it was like a fellowship of frugality. I mean, you'd have influencers doing TikTok videos, Instagram, YouTube. Look what I found at 99 cent only. And what I loved about these places, you'd find retirees. You'd find all sorts of, you know, white folks, black folks, Latinos, Asians, everyone. And this is just at the 99 cent only store in Santana. I could only imagine how it was like in other places. And that was the other cool thing about that. Like the Dollar Generals and Family Dollar, whatever they call themselves, stores, like they tended to be on, you know, places that were a little bit more economically distressed. And 99 cent only stores, you could find one in Studio City. You could find one in Santa Monica. You could find one in Colton. You could find one in Santana. They were so Southern California, and you didn't realize how ubiquitous they are until you realize, oh, they're probably not going to be around anymore.
Yeah. And I really like their displays, their window displays. I just aesthetically, those are really pleasing with everything lined up.
Oh, my God.
Just they look really cool.
Yeah. When I walked in, you go to your right and you have this humongous wall of Top Ramen noodle, cup noodle, Korean noodles. And then after that, like ripoffs of all of them.
Okay. Well, tell us how it all started. It was founded by a guy named Dave Gold, who was kind of an LA icon himself. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, so Dave Gold's family had a discount liquor store. And so he realized, again, Southern California has always had this cult of frugality, swap meets, Salvation Armies, garage sales, half off warehouses. And he decided he wanted to open up a store. The very first one was in Westchester, 1982. Day opens, lines out the door, and he's like, all right, well, obviously, I hit into something. So it was family owned up until the 2000s, really. And his children were a part of it for, you know, about, I think, 5 or 6 years later. And they had fun. When the Dodgers lost 99 games one year, they congratulated them with ads saying, congratulations on losing 99 games. Mm-hmm. They and everything, at least for decades, or rather good time, it was no more than 99 cents. I mean, it made news in 2008 during the Great Recession when they decided to raise their prices by like $2 more.
Well, there is a lot of research showing that these kinds of stores can create food deserts. And when they go in, they drive out independent stores and then people don't have access to fresh produce. What do you think of that criticism?
Well, that was interesting because 99 cent only stores did not sell fresh produce for a long time. And in response to that, they started selling fresh produce. So when I went there, there was bananas that looked fine. I mean, there was apples that looked better than some of the apples that you could find at the quote unquote more respectable grocery stores. And so, yeah, you had the mercados, the mom and pops. I mean, I do got to say, at least in Santana, you do have that ecosystem of mercados. So it's almost like with working class folks, okay, you go to your corner store when you want to buy something a little bit either better or just have more options. That's when you would go to 99 cent only. If you want to splurge, that's when you have to drive a little bit further to Ralph's or, you know, Stater Brothers or wherever you go. But these places, they were neighborhood stores. So they did take over whatever the smaller stores had, and they would sell whatever that particular population needed.
So is this an opportunity for the local stores to come back in and use that real estate, or is that far gone?
I mean, we'll see. I mean, Mercaditos, you've at least in Santana and Orange County, that's where I'm more familiar with. But even in East LA, you've had some stores that go on for decades. And this is the thing. In Southern California, there's always going to be people who are looking for those discounts, who want to live frugally and also want that neighborhood connection. There was one guy that I saw there at 99 cent only. He was telling people, yeah, I've been working here 15 years. You get to know your person. In Amazon, if you just go through Amazon, and yeah, Amazon does groceries as well and these other products, you don't learn anyone. You learn your local locker. That's not the same as a 99 cent only store.
Well, there's a group of investors trying to save them. It's led by this guy named Mark Miller, the former president of Big Lots and Pick and Save. What do you think of that plan?
We'll see. I mean, Pick and Save, that was another brand, legendary brand. My mom used to take us there, but that went away a long time ago, got replaced by Big Lot. But this guy knows that there is a market and really a necessity for these deeply discounted places where people could still buy stuff. I mean, that's the thing. Like, people would always try to knock 99-cent only stores for selling inferior products. Now, yeah, there was some stuff maybe that was not as good as other stuff, but you would find a lot of good stuff there. And again, when you have, I think in Southern California, it was about 145 locations. They're big places. Getting rid of them is going to leave a huge hole, as you talked earlier about food deserts. And so there's a market there to be able to get some. So we'll see. I mean, also, okay, so are you going to bring back 99-cent only store? The very first question people are going to ask, are you going to raise the prices? Because if you're going to raise the prices, then you're no better than a Stater Brothers.
Gustavo Arellano, LA Times columnist and 99-cent store enthusiast. Thank you.
Gracias.
Tomorrow on Press Play, speaking of enthusiasts, we'll talk to Evan Kleiman. She'll have artichoke recipes for you. Also, we will have your weekend movie reviews. So come back for all of that and more. And don't forget to follow us on the socials. We're at KCRW. I am at The Mad Brand. And you can also download and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening today. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you back here again tomorrow.